A lot of people have also been saying that the niche sites are dead. I started my career in building a niche site. It sounds like you started your career in SEO by building out an SEO strategy for a niche site. To all of those people that say niche sites are dead, what do you think? Are niche sites dead, or is there still an opportunity to build niche sites in 2024?
I don't think they're dead. I mean, you know, I get the sentiment. I understand the emotion because I've been there, you know. As I mentioned at the start, I've not only lost my niche site, but lost it in the middle of trying to have it acquired. And actually, the September update hit another one of my niche sites, but it was completely deserved. I was using far too much AI, and it was well deserved. I don't think they're dead. You know, we have a niche site that has probably 5x in traffic over the last month or so from the March update. So I can honestly say they're dead.
Hi, and welcome to the Optimize Podcast. My name is Nate Matherson, and I am your host. On this weekly podcast, we sit down with some of the smartest minds in content marketing and SEO. Our goal is to give you perspective and insights on what's moving the needle in organic search. Today, I'm thrilled to sit down with Niall Frater. Niall is the founder of Mass SEO, an agency that specializes in creating content marketing programs at scale for technology companies. On this week's episode, Niall and I chat about building SEO programs from zero to one, scaling SEO channels for startups, improving content creation processes, and so much more. And this episode of the Optimize Podcast is brought to you by Positional. If you don't know by now, my name is Nate, and I'm one of the co-founders of Positional. And we just launched our toolset publicly in late March. That means that you can go to positional.com and sign up for our toolset and play around. We've got a trial. We'd love for you to check out our tools for keyword research, internal linking, content optimization, and we've even got a couple tool sets for analytics as well. And you can check it out at positional.com. Niall, thank you so much for coming on the Optimize Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So the first question I ask all of our guests is, how did you get into the world of content marketing and SEO?
By accident, I would say. So I've always been in the kind of startup world and sort of playing around with different things there. And I decided in 2018 that I wanted to acquire companies instead of kind of trying to build them from scratch. And I ended up buying a website that was probably you would call it a niche site. I didn't think of it in that terms at the time. And it was primarily kind of driven by SEO. It was called nocode.tech, and it was in the kind of no-code space. So we would do reviews on Webflow and Bubble and Zapier and all these kind of no-code tools. And so the site always kind of grew by SEO, and I just sort of learned that over time. It came kind of with SEO pre-built, and so all I was doing is maybe building more programmatic pages or writing more content, and not with any kind of particular plan. And then around about 2021, I had a potential acquirer, and you know, we had a really good conversation. We started to get into negotiations. I told them what our traffic was because the traffic was the main thing they were interested in. And at some point during those negotiations, I got clapped with a Google update, and the traffic I think went down to about a third of what it was. And so I essentially had maybe 3-4 months to try and like learn SEO fundamentally and kind of get into the nitty-gritty details and try and get the traffic back before we did due diligence and they went in and checked the traffic themselves and you know, saw that it dropped or stayed where it was. And so I essentially locked myself in a room for 3 months straight. Every day I would get up in the morning, I would try some new SEO stuff. I would talk to friends who were kind of had more expertise than I did, and just try to make it work. And kind of miraculously, I think 1 week before we did due diligence, the traffic recovered. I mean, it had been starting to steadily recover, but another Google update happened. You know, the kind of good work that I'd done had been acknowledged. And I think after a few months of then, you know, the deal closed, we then went to work for the acquired company. And I think after a couple of months in there and sort of helping them with their SEO, I think I just started to realize, oh, I actually might know partly what I'm talking about here. And as you know, Nate, because you've helped me with a couple of SEO issues in the past, I certainly don't know everything, but you know, I've picked up a lot of skills along the way with no code, and then now we're working with so many different clients from my SEO agency, seeing so many different websites that I have a pretty good grasp now of how things work, you know.
Yes, and I've asked this question 40 some odd times now, and it seems like all of us find SEO accidentally. You know, I've made this joke more than once that none of us as kids want to grow up and become SEOs. At least maybe this next generation will if they listen to the Optimized podcast each week. But I do want to talk to you about algorithm updates. And I also want to talk to you about niche sites. And let's start with algorithm updates. It's been a pretty volatile few years in the SERPs. And it seems like things are more volatile than they've ever been in terms of the cadence of updates and the movements in the SERPs that we're seeing post updates. And a few weeks back, there was the March core update. There were also the spam updates, which Google put out quite a bit of documentation on. And, you know, I don't want to spend this entire episode talking to you about algorithm updates, but I have to ask, what do you make of the recent algorithm updates? Have you seen a lot of volatility? Are you doing anything different? I'd be curious to get your thoughts.
I'm a little bit weird in that I love Google updates. It is the most exciting thing in SEO to me. And maybe that just means like I've done well out of most of them. But, you know, I tend to find that on a normal month where there's not a Google update, I'm going to get some traction in my SEO and it's going to continue to grow and kind of grow week on week. But what I tend to find is when you have an update, you know, either one or two things happens. Either number one, your traffic jumps up heavily and something you know, good happens essentially with your SEO results, or, you know, something bad happens to all your competitors' websites and that gives you a little bit of a run. So, you know, a bit of survivorship bias in there because I think they've been going pretty well for us and pretty well for the client recently. But, you know, honestly, I think people have been very critical of all of Google's kind of updates really since the September update of last year. And then in particular, I think a lot of people felt that this March update didn't move the needle. I don't really agree with that. I think most of the sites that I see hurting from the Google core update, they're just not very good. And, you know, maybe the articles look decently written, informative, but maybe they're lacking opinion, maybe they're lacking expertise. I think generally from the websites that I've seen, the websites that are genuinely offering something new, something interesting, I think are doing well. And I think the only websites I've seen do it poorly are websites where, again, maybe it's a good product, but is that content a unique product? Is it adding something or is it really just, you know, rehashing something? So, yeah, there's still some things that I think Google have to work on. I still see a lot of our competitors using pretty bad AI content and somehow still ranking, and that's very frustrating. But, you know, I really have not seen any websites that didn't deserve it being hurt. Most of them seem pretty bad to me, you know.
It's often the case that a website that's been negatively impacted by an algorithm update does deserve it. I know lately on Twitter, it seems like, at least on Twitter, that SEOs have been complaining about SEO and been complaining about algorithm updates more than I've ever seen. And, you know, a lot of people are saying that, like, Google has been unfair to them. And I mean, we need to remember that, like, Google is a platform that we're building on top of. They don't owe us anything. And a lot of people have also been saying that niche sites are dead. I started my career in building a niche site. It sounds like you started your career in SEO by building out an SEO strategy for a niche site. To all of those people that say niche sites are dead, what do you think? Are niche sites dead, or is there still an opportunity to build niche sites in 2024?
I don't think they're dead. I mean, you know, I get the sentiment. I understand the emotion because I've been there, you know. As I mentioned at the start, I've not only lost my niche site, but lost it in the middle of trying to have it acquired. And actually, the September update hit another one of my niche sites, but it was completely deserved. I was using far too much AI, and it was well deserved. I don't think they're dead. You know, we have a niche site that has probably 5x in traffic over the last month or so from the March update. So I can honestly say they're dead. I think this, you know, everything that I see out there that has genuine human content, that is, and by human content, I mean has human expertise, human insight, the person's been there, the person's done that, and the person's proving that in the right way, I think they're doing well. I've seen a couple of examples on Twitter where, you know, there was a guy who had his travel site, had his own pictures on it, and other people were reusing that. Other people had pictures of his wife and his kids enjoying, you know, Thailand or something. And I think that's where I'm disappointed in Google. You know, we should really be catching that thing. And we expect that Google takes care of these types of, you know, I guess theft, honestly, of your content. But, you know, these are the exceptions, I think, that prove the rule. And the rule is, you know, Google is just getting better and better and better at tightening up human content. And if you have that, your niche site will work. And if you don't, you know, maybe it won't.
We're going off script already, Niall. You mentioned there, like, you know, in this example site, they've got, you know, unique photos of them with their family at some location that they've traveled to. They've created what it sounds like very unique and authentic content to their experience. Would you say that, like, from your perspective, like, as SEOs creating content, we need to have something unique or create something unique within our pages? Is that fairly important these days?
I think so. You know, I think the debate about AI content is kind of related here, because what I always say about AI content is, by the very nature of how an LLM works, AI content is the average of everything that's ever been written. And I think at the point that we're at, where automated systems can just create content en masse, I think you need to have a unique perspective. Otherwise, what's the point in reading it? The thing I've been conflicted about recently is Reddit performing very well in Google. So I frequently Google things and add Reddit to the end of the search query so that I can find a Reddit opinion. And there's been a lot of controversy recently because obviously Google have had a deal with Reddit, and that might be why they're ranking so well. But, you know, I think if you forget that for a second, I think honestly Reddit, discussion forums, etc., the reason people do use them for research is they have unique opinions. The opinions that other people feel strongly about, which is a social signal that we as humans care about, they're upvoted, or they otherwise make it to the top, they're otherwise surfaced. I think where discussion sites let you down is you often only get half of an answer. You know, okay, now I know the best places to eat in Thailand, but I want to know where to stay. And unfortunately, this Reddit user has not told me, so I no longer have his opinion. So to me, that's where SEO can thrive is, you know, we have the opportunity to own our own website, to put a comprehensive information on it. But if it doesn't have your own opinion, if it doesn't have something unique to add, then, you know, the technology landscape just changed, right? The average of everything can be automated out. So if you don't have something to say unique, then your niche site is not going to work.
Yeah, and I agree with you that, you know, AI-generated content is very much an average of what's already been published. And you'd I guess, have to make a difficult argument to say, like, why does your AI-generated content deserve to exist? And, you know, for the longest time, I've been, like, screaming from the rooftops that, like, we shouldn't be using AI-generated content. But we had a guest on pretty recently on the podcast, Alex from Greg, and he actually walked our listeners through their really unique strategy to create content with AI, but using like their own UGC data set from their app as like the method to like create this AI generated content. I thought it was like such a unique approach. And so that's something that I've kind of changed my mind on, is that like AI generated content, I don't think is the right approach for most companies, but I think there are some use cases where it could be a really helpful tool when combined with another data source that you might have access to. At least that's just a very anecdotal example that we chatted about recently on the pod. But I do want to ask, because, you know, everyone tries to analyze these algorithm updates after the fact and try to figure out like who the winners and losers are. And in my analysis, at least over the last year, I've noticed that it seems that like pure content websites have struggled more than websites with actual products or services. And so I guess I'm going to ask you a question here. Do you think that Google is splitting pure content websites into a different bucket? Or is it just that pure content websites might have the characteristics of websites that are lower quality versus companies that actually have products and services? So I know that was a very long question, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts.
I don't think it's directly having, I don't know, like a checkout, a product and a service on your website. Maybe it is, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but even if you are selling, you know, the most generic thing that other people are selling, maybe you're selling supplements, for example, you're still going to have some unique insight into that industry because, hey, you've went through the hassle of learning about the products and, you know, maybe figuring out who the suppliers are, how do you ship them? What do people want? How do you have to sell these? So even in the most generic products, you already have something unique to say. You might not intentionally realize you're doing that. You might be copying your competition, but you have some uniqueness to add, and most likely you care to some extent about what you're doing, even if that's only slight. Whereas if you're running a content site, you know, this product you're talking about is one of 100 that you're kind of shilling for affiliate money. You're not really going to care. You know, maybe you care more if they pay out more, and maybe you'll go and look for more viable things. The chances are you've not used the product, you don't have anything generic to say, and you know, an LLM tool could look at the tool's website and say the same thing that you have said. So I think by having the service and product, you two things happen, right? Number one, yes, you have that unique experience. I think number two, you also have a stronger opinion. I think one of the problems, so you know, with my agency, we create hybrid human AI content. So we use AI to create or to get the kind of structure of the article, and then we use humans to input, you know, opinions and thoughts, etc. And I think the problem that I see with most AI content is it's deliberately neutral. You know, it says, hey, this product might be good, but it might not be good. It's not saying you want this because of X, Y, Z reason. But if I'm trying to sell you a product, that's what I'm going to say, right? I'm going to say you want this because of X, Y, Z reason. You should consider it because of that. And I think that is a signal that Google's picking up. It's trying to move away from neutrality and move towards, you know, opinions that are more extreme in their endorsement of a particular product.
That's so interesting that you mentioned that. And I like to joke with some of our customers that, you know, even if that AI-generated piece of content ranks in search, like, are you actually going to be able to convert a customer from it? Or is it... is that person just reading like a Wikipedia page type article that has no emotion, no feeling? They're not going to want to connect with your brand or product. And so I think that point you made is such a good one. And I know that at Mass SEO, your agency, you work with a lot of startups, often Series A and Series B stage companies. And I'd imagine that these businesses, given their stage, already have fairly established websites by the time you start working with them as a client. And so I'm curious, when you first start working with a client, what are one or two of those big mistakes that they've made that you either need to undo or adjust as you begin your work with them?
I think there's a couple of obvious ones for anyone who works in SEO. You know, most clients we take on who are established, their site structure is just not very good. It's hard to find a blog. Maybe they have a lot of orphaned kind of pages. They just haven't thought from an SEO point of view of how is Google going to think about this site and crawl it and understand how it all fits together. So, you know, we're often either fixing that immediately or after we start content production, we're starting to have to fix it, you know, within the first month or two because the blog becomes unwieldy or too hidden away or something like that. And I think the other one is just, and again, another obvious one is inconsistencies in how they do meta titles. You know, for example, they're doing titles that are really designed for people reading the blog, not for people who are coming from Google. They maybe have, you know, bad slugs, bad kind of practices, maybe they're using schema wrong, but just all the things that you expect. The thing that I find is the hardest item to change with clients that is less clear is most clients that we work with think that their writing quality is really, really good. And because we produce so much content, you know, minimum 20 articles a month, they assume that ours is going to be comparatively bad. And then you start to get into this debate of what do you mean by quality? And what I mean by quality is most of our clients have borderline unreadable articles. You know, they have paragraphs that are maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 lines long. You know, you just get lost and bored in the middle of them. They're not using any format, and we've had clients before where they have literally zero bullet points in their articles, or you know, it just becomes dense and difficult to read. And I think people have this expectation, especially in niches where Maybe you're writing for engineers or data scientists, or people with a strong academic background where they're debatably used to kind of dive into big meaty articles. And so they're always thinking of, well, none of that matters because the content is great. The value of what we're saying is great. And I disagree with that. I think even the most hardened engineers will get bored in a long, drawn-out article. And the problem you always have with Google is you're always fighting against that urge to hit the back button and choose from one of your other nine options on the front page. And so, that's the biggest thing that we always try to change is we say, hey, take on our style guide. Let us edit some of your articles. It's an uphill battle, you know?
Yeah, don't get me started on slugs. I find myself talking about slugs and title tags almost every single day with our customers. And I totally agree with you that like readability and content UX UI is so important. In an extreme anecdotal example, I was talking to one of our customers the other day, and they sent me a page on their blog, and I kid you not, it was one paragraph. It was like a 1,000-word blog post in one paragraph. There was no spacing, and they wanted to know why it wasn't ranking well. We won't mention them by name on this podcast, but if you're listening, you know who you are. I know that at your agency, like you work with a lot of clients who maybe haven't scaled SEO strategies before, and the first thing they might want to do is scale up content production. And it sounds like you do create a lot of content for your clients at Mass SEO. Startups always ask me, Nate, how much content should I create? And so I'm going to ask you, for a startup that's serious about SEO, but they haven't scaled this channel before, how much content should they expect to be creating each week or each month if they're serious about the channel?
The way I tend to describe this to clients, one of the biggest kind of pushbacks we get is, oh, why do you want to write 20 articles or 30 articles a month? Can we not just start with like 5 or 10? And I think the answer is you can, right? You can write any amount of content you want. And I think the two key principles you need to stick to are consistency. So are you publishing every week, every couple of days, something like that? And then just that kind of velocity. Like you can publish maybe only 4 articles a month, but the faster that you publish and the more that you publish, the quicker SEO is going to work. And I think that's for two reasons. And this is what we educate our clients on is when we create a high volume of content, not only are we just covering more surface area quickly, the average article I would say that we write, and I think this is true for anybody, is it's not just going to cover one keyword, it's going to cover maybe 10, maybe 15 different keywords, keyword variations. And so the more surface area you have, the more opportunities you have to rank. I think that's basic and obvious. But I think the second thing is when you write an SEO article, you're actually conducting a series of experiments. You're trying to figure out, is this article even valuable to my target audience? Am I targeting the right audience? Am I speaking to that audience in a way that is going to work both from a educating them point of view, but a converting them point of view. Am I using the right meta title? Am I, again, back to that content quality from from a few minutes ago? Am I creating this content in such a way that someone wants to read it? And so if you're only doing 4 articles a month or 8 articles a month, you only have so many shots at these experiments. If you start to ramp up to 10 articles a month, to 15, to 20, to more, you suddenly just have more shots that you can take at the goal. You have more experiments that you can run. You can try different meta titles. You can try different personas. And I think you can also afford to go after smaller keywords. What I see a lot is when people create low volumes of content, they then feel that they have to really squeeze and maximize the value out of that. So they're trying to go after a big keyword that, maybe has a high difficulty, has a few thousand searches a month. And this is maybe, like the fifth article on their blog. It's never going to happen. So I think it's more shots and goals. I think it's the ability to experiment more. And so there's not one specific golden number, but I do tend to subscribe to the idea that as long as the quality is high enough and the keywords are useful enough, the keyword strategy is good enough, the more content, the merrier, you know?
Yeah, I like that point on shots on goal, because there is randomness in search. You could publish an article today and it could rank like out of the gate on the first page, which has happened on our website recently. But then also too, like you could write an article and Google does substantially nothing with it for the first 4 months. And then 4 months in, it all of a sudden starts to rank well, and you've done nothing differently between those two pieces of content. And the keywords might be similar in terms of competition. And so there's always that randomness to search, which is often very hard to communicate to someone who's just getting started with SEO. And so to your point, like, yes, if we're creating more content, it gives us more shots on goal, more opportunities for experimentation. And I'd also think too that like the faster that you can get the client or the startup like bought into the strategy that it's working, the better. And so I'm guessing that if we like front load a lot of content, it probably also helps to get that client like feeling like it's kind of going in the right direction versus a slower burn. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, for sure. And I think the front loading makes a lot of sense. I think most agencies, and frankly, this is true of us as well, as we price things on a monthly basis. We say we'll create, you know, 10, 20 pieces this month, the next month, so on and so forth. And that means by month six, those pieces were published and they're only at the start of our journey, obviously, right? Whereas if we published all of that content in month one, we may have to go back and optimize it. We may have to go back and introduce learnings, but there's just more time in the SERPs. And I think the most frustrating thing for us and for clients is when, you know, why is this not performing? It just needs more time in the SERPs. You know, it's a process, it's going to take time. And that's always it's a hard answer, especially when you can spend your money on something like ads and get a return tomorrow.
Yeah, and I know given the amount of content you're creating for your clients at Mass SEO that you've probably got like a fairly large team of writers that you work with, at least I would guess. And so my question here, because again, I always get asked this question, how do you go about sourcing content writers? Or at least how have you sourced content writers to join your team at Mass SEO?
We're not particularly unique in how we source them. You know, we put up job adverts and we try to incentivize referrals. And I think we find that referrals get the best quality of writer, not only because people don't tend to refer people unless they're sure they're going to work out, but I think also because it kind of creates an immediate support network. You know, we hired a writer off of a referral last month, and already he's been out for a few beers with the writer who referred him. They've exchanged notes, they're doing each other's processes, and their writing looks almost identical, which is great for us. You know, we like consistency in writing because then we kind of know what to expect and we know how a writer's going to approach a certain article. So referrals, I think, once you can get that going, is the best method. I think the painful lessons we have learned is around about, I've worked in startups a lot of my career, but I also have a portion of my career in the corporate background. And certainly the way it works there is you'll hire somebody, you know, you'll upskill them, you'll work on them for a long time. And you might hire people with a recognition that, hey, this person's going to be minimally productive for a year or more. And that's certainly not something that, unfortunately, we can stomach in the agency world. You know, we really need people who can hit the ground running. And what I think we've found is, and this isn't be controversial, but I think you can either write or you can't. I think it's a really hard thing to teach people. And you know, the writing might be okay, it might hit all the goals you've set out, hit all the rules you set out, but it just isn't nice to read. And I think that's an issue we've run into a lot, where we hire people who maybe have the right attitude, the right background, but they're not a natural writer. They gained that ability, or they tried to gain that ability later in life, and it just doesn't work out. And I think the other sort of correlated lesson to that is, we have tried hiring writers without a writing test before. I just hate giving people work to do in a job process, because I'm well aware that this is one job out of 100 that they've probably applied to, and if they're sitting writing an article for all of them, that sucks, it's painful. So we do paid writing tests, but we must do writing tests. Every time we try to skip the writing test, we are always surprised in a very negative way. And so, you know, we certainly don't have any unique tips on sourcing people, but I would never hire a writer without trying out their work. And I think it's a good opportunity as well for them to make sure that they like your company's approach, your editing style, etc. You know, otherwise you're just taking a shot in the wind.
We're about halfway through this episode of the Optimize podcast, and I just want to give a special shout out to our sponsor. You might have guessed, positional.com. Check out their awesome set of tools for content marketers and SEOs. And now back to the podcast. Well, I thought your point on referrals, asking your best writers who else they know, is such a great tip and strategy. And we have an article on our website about how to hire content writers. And so after this, I'm probably going to go back and update that article with a section on asking your writers for referrals, because that is such a good point. I've found too, anecdotally, that like our best writers tend to also know other very good writers. And I also agree with you that it's very hard to coach someone into becoming a better writer. You kind of have it or you don't. You know, I wish I could disagree with you on more things now, but I also agree with you that writing tests are extremely important in, as part of the hiring process. And, you know, my approach is, you know, I might post a job on a platform like Upwork, if I am using Upwork, and, you know, I might hire like three or four people to a test project and ultimately pick like that one that performs the best on the project and just kind of rinse and repeat. But usually for me, platforms like Upwork are like a last resort if I can't find quality talent elsewhere. And, you know, a second kind of follow-up question to this, and this is another question that like our customers who tend to often be early stage startups always ask me is, they say, Nate, how much should I expect to pay for a piece of content? Like, what does a piece of content cost? And so I'm going to ask you that question. Like, generally, what does a piece of content cost these days?
I think it's a hard thing to answer because there's so many variables in it. So, you know, my answer would be a good piece of quality. A good piece of quality content can cost less than $100. That is what we pay on a per article basis. But there's so many things that go into that. You know, we can do that because we hire in-house writers. So actually, we're really just paying up front for a bunch of articles. And then once you start to factor in, okay, the editing cost of that article, we have to add that on top. Maybe there's a research factor, you know, we're sub $100 because I'm not factoring the time that I spend briefing that article, learning the client, blah, blah, blah. And so I think in reality, the price starts to go up to probably $200, $300, maybe even $500 per article. And again, it really depends on what you mean by quality, because AI should have brought down the cost of articles. And I think the problem you have there is so many people are either just, okay, let me write everything with AI and just edit it, and therefore an article costs $10. But that's not really what I would call a quality article. On the other hand, you have people who say, let's spend, you know, $1,000 or $2,000. You know, let's get a really, you know, accomplished, prestigious freelancer who's written for, you know, national kind of media. Let's get them to go through it and write it. And that might be the solution, but I would also argue that probably someone else could have done that job for less money and got the same result. And I think there's a real intangible when you're doing content marketing, when you really care about thought leadership, when you really care about a piece just blowing up on social media, where, you know, working with prestigious, expensive people can make sense. But I think for SEO, everything really has to be a cost ratio. You know, is it worth spending X amount to get after Y keyword? And so, yeah, maybe not the most useful answer because it's so variable, but I just don't think you can put a price tag on a piece of content.
Yeah, you know, and as far as like the individual cost of an article goes, like I try to look more so at like the cost of the totality in which we're trying to build. I try not to zoom in on like any single cost of an individual article on my site. And I try to think broadly to say like, okay, we're going to create 250 articles. And this is the traffic that we think we can drive for. What is it going to cost us to create those 250 articles? And then to look at the traffic and say, was that worth it? And I think when you look at it from that perspective, it's often clearly worth it. Whereas to your point, if you're spending $300 for a piece of content all in on a single piece, it can sometimes be hard to say like, oh, that individual piece of content was worth it. And, you know, you've mentioned AI tools a few times on this episode, and it sounds like there is a place for them. But also, like to your point, we don't want to create entire pieces of content with AI. I guess my question for you is like, where are you finding leverage with AI tooling in the content creation process, or where has it been most helpful for you in the work that you do with your clients?
So we at Mass ultimately view AI as an aid for writer's block, you know. And what I mean by that is, if I ask you to write an article today on plants, you're going to have to go and figure out, okay, what are all the different types of plants, and what do people even want to know about plants, and, you know, all these little details that you just need to know before you can even start to inject opinion and insight and kind of value. And what AI is really good at is answering that for you. So here's everything you need to know. Here's the benefits of plants. Here's the history of plants if you want that, you know, etc. And the problem is most people stop there. You know, they just go, okay, great, let me just edit this so it sounds less kind of cringy AI, you know, samey, and let me publish this. But at that point, all you have is information, because again, the AI is the average of all the content out there. And so the way that we use it is that writer block. And then what we want to do is have our writers inject opinion, inject insight. We want them to go do their own research and try and do, you know, something that at the minute only the human mind is good at, which is kind of synthesizing different sources of information together to create a new piece of information that we can then share with people. And so I think AI is great for that. I think AI can be good at briefing, but you know, again, it has the same issue that if your writers are not well equipped to go out and do research, then they're just going to create something average. And the thing that we're starting to experiment with is using AI agents to start doing things like editing. So, for example, in the editing process, we care about spelling and grammar. We care about, you know, have they went through every paragraph and made sure that there's only 3 or 4 lines. Something that some of our clients love and some that hate is we use an extreme amount of bold, almost bionic reading style, where we just want to make it possible for someone to skim through an entire article. And when we bring on new writers, they struggle to get their head around it because it's pretty different. And so, you know, we could also, that's also another part of an edit process. And so with AI agents, what you could do is have one AI, which is just specifically trained, if you want to use that word, to look for spelling and grammar. You can have one that's trained on the client's tone of voice. You can have one that's trained on maybe there's words you don't want to use. You know, we find ourselves having to remove big words, as I call them, from our writer's vocabulary, maximized, streamlined. You know, these words that people use a lot but don't really mean anything. And so with AI agents, you can have all of these different kind of AI programs going and looking and really focusing on each of these elements. And then you can have another AI that overlooks them and oversees them and makes sure that they're doing everything properly and they're not, you know, missing things or editing things incorrectly. And so I think that we are still at the infancy of making that work and making it valuable. I think the industry in general is still in its infancy. You know, we're really good at writing tools now, but we're not so great at AI agent tools yet. But I think over the next year, that's going to be a big explosion, you know.
Yeah, GPT-5, it's coming out soon, we think. at least that's what I've heard. And yeah, I do think your point is a good one that, you know, especially in the outlining process, AI tools can be quite helpful. And actually on last week's episode of the Optimized Podcast, we did an entire episode on content outlines and content briefs with Dwayne Hogan. And he kind of explained to us his process for using AI tools in the content briefing process. And so for all our listeners, if you haven't checked out that episode with Dwayne yet, I definitely would recommend it. And, you know, final question that I'm always asked that I want to ask you is, how long does it take? Like, you know, assuming we're starting with, like, let's say a Series A company, they're serious about this channel, they've got an established website already, but they haven't worked on SEO yet. How long does it take to start to see results for a client like that?
I think it depends on how you define results. What I would say is we tell our clients that by month 3, you will see that SEO has traction. You know, maybe things are on page 2, maybe something got onto page 1, but you will see that content's been published and that content is moving up the rankings. And then around about month 4 is typically when we tell clients to expect to see something on page 1. And then month 5, okay, hopefully we've started to get at least one thing, maybe 2 or 3, into, you know, the top kind of 1 to 3 positions. And what we always tell people is, really, until you get in there, unless it's a mega niche keyword or you've got a super valuable article that just destroys everything else in the service but just hasn't quite been given the place it rightfully deserves, you know, until then you're not really going to see conversions because there's no traffic coming, you know. Even position 5 is not what it used to be. Position 4 isn't, it really had to be 1 to 3. So we expect that you can, we call this a loop, right? An article gets published, it gets ran, it ranks high enough to get traffic, the traffic converts. We always say you can kind of prove that loop out within 4 to 5 months. But it's back to this idea of shots on target and ability to experiment. You know, for certainly the velocity that we publish at, by the time we get to month 5, we've published 80 pieces of content. So we have a really wide surface area to rank, to try different things, to try different personas, to try different, you know, sales pitches and conversion attempts as well. And I think there is this real mentality. I hear from clients all the time that SEO is going to take 8 or 9 months. And I think that was true when, you know, the SEO zeitgeist is that everybody writes between 4 and 6 articles a month, maybe 8 at a push. Now that people are enabled to do 10, 20, 30, I think it's a totally different world, you know. And I think if you look at a lot of big, you know, in air quotation marks here, overnight success companies, usually the volume of content, I think, is the underlying factor of how they've managed to progress so quickly with SEO, you know.
For sure. If a client came to you and said, now we want to publish 100 articles a month over the next 5 months, is that too much? Can you hit a limit of too much if there is that surface area to cover?
I would love to find out. I'm going to say no, because people do it with programmatic SEO, you know, and that's kind of where I got my start, was publishing 50 to 100 programmatic pages or more every month. So I think you can, you know, there's no technical limitation there. The limitation becomes, is there enough things for you to write about? Are there enough things for you to write about that are going to drive conversions, meaning there's meaningful ROI? You know, we work with a few clients who, every client wants conversions, right? And even if they say they don't, they always do 3 or 4 months in when your line item is starting to look expensive in P&L. But we have a lot of clients who genuinely do care about, they want brand awareness. They want to be, when someone thinks about a topic as large as mortgages, they want to be number one for everything. And they're willing to accept that that's going to take time, it's going to take money, and it might not be a huge ROI, you know, until you're really a household name. And some people are just willing to do that. You know, I think it can work. I think it can be done. I don't think it's easy. And I don't think AI is a solution to do it. Certainly not, you know, by itself. But I'm hoping we get the chance to try that challenge, and I'll let you know how it goes.
Well, speaking of mortgages, and mortgage rates was a keyword that I had tried to rank for back in the day with a small degree of success. It was a very competitive keyword. And, you know, I started my career in a very competitive space, being consumer finance. And I would actually argue that SEO is maybe more competitive than it's ever been. I guess my question to you is, do you take on clients that are in extremely competitive spaces? And if so, is building out an SEO channel in a high competition space the same playbook or a different one?
So yes, we do. We have clients in the AI niche. We have clients in the no-code niche, where almost every valuable keyword is an 80 plus KD. We have clients in the healthcare space. I'll probably give it away if I mention any medications, but ranking for some very, very, very popular medications. And I think the strategy is slightly different, but not that much. You know, it's ultimately still the same foundation of, we have to build lots of content consistently. It has to hit keywords very precisely. We have to answer everything that someone has, and we actually have a client where you know, their competitor has more backlinks than TechCrunch, you know, which is something I like to say a lot to our team when I'm like, this is difficult, this is really tough SEO. And you know, the way that we're approaching that is just by trying to answer absolutely everything that the other competitors in that space haven't answered. You know, where can we get into super long tail stuff? Where can we get into like questions that are maybe not worded correctly, but there's something there? And how can we use, you know, these really small keywords to build up topical authority so that Google says, hey, I'm going to give you a shot at the king here. I'm going to let you go after this. I think ultimately it's very hard for SEO to do this on its own. You know, you also have to have a competent social strategy. You have to have some kind of word of mouth growth. You know, you really have to have other channels performing, and that's something that I think Google has changed a lot in the last 6 months, where these kind of off-channel signals are becoming really, really important. And we definitely see a big difference in clients who has that traction. You know, they're on podcasts or newsletters, have been talked about on Twitter. That makes our job much, much easier. It can still be done. You know, we have some competitive clients who really don't have that kind of traction. Maybe they're in a boring industry where there's not much to talk about, etc. But the more outside help you have alongside Google, the easier it becomes.
I totally agree that I think Google has gotten a lot better at understanding off-page signals that are not necessarily backlinks. And one of the earlier episodes we did on the Optimized podcast was with Akash from Windley. They're in like a fairly competitive healthcare space. And Akash mentioned to us on the episode that every time they went viral on TikTok, they saw a noticeable lift in organic search performance, and it seemed to be sustained. And that, you know, it's a very anecdotal experience, but his argument is that even a platform like TikTok, Google has gotten very good at seeing how that type of a platform could drive engagement and send traffic back to given pages, which could then have a positive impact on, you know, search performance for those pages and the entire website. So I do definitely agree with you there. And my next question is on scaling your agency. I do want to talk a little bit about that. You know, you and I offline have chatted about, you know, growing an agency, which, you know, I've never done, but it sounds quite stressful as you take on more and more clients. With your agency, Mass SEO, have you experienced any growing pains over the last year? And if so, like, what are some of those growing pains that you experienced as you started to take on more and more clients?
Yeah, a lot of growing pains. We've went from zero to kind of seven-figure revenue in under a year. And really most of that has come in the last kind of few months. And yeah, I mean, you know, I used to look about 10 years younger. That's probably number one. Sleep has definitely been sacrificed. I haven't had a lot in the last 6 months. But, you know, I think a lot of the growing pains that we've went through have been fairly typical. I think because we create so much content, we have put a lot of these problems on steroids. You know, like beginning the first time you go from creating your own content to bringing in a writer is a step. The first time that you go from having one writer to two writers, and you know, because we create minimum 20 articles a month, sometimes 30, the editing burden is huge. You know, we're editing so many articles every week that we've had to put in processes. We've had to figure out, how do we do this at scale? How do we make sure that people aren't just getting bored of, okay, this is article number 1 of 50 I've got to edit this week. How do we keep it fresh? How do we keep them interested and engaged? That's been really difficult. I think hiring has been really difficult. I shared some of those struggles earlier where I actually, funnily enough, have a really extensive background in recruitment. I used to do it in the kind of corporate world. And for some reason, it didn't really prepare me for hiring writers. It didn't prepare me for doing this fairly unique thing of our writers write 2 articles per day, which when you tell most people that, they just don't understand it. It doesn't compute. And they're really surprised that our articles are pretty good. But, you know, figuring out how to hire people for that process, how to make that process sustainable and enjoyable and be something that they can do over the long term, that has been really difficult as well. And but I think the encouraging thing is, you know, every other business I've started has been, let's say, less certain, you know. And by that, I mean, I'd be sitting figuring out what is the next thing to do. You know, it's a common thing when you're starting a technology startup of there are maybe 10 different actions you could take if you can even identify them. And each of them has an unknown outcome. The thing that I think is fun with an agency is, you know what's going to happen. You know that you just have to go and close more sales. That will bring in more revenue. You can hire X, Y, Z person. You can offer a new service. And there's a real obvious loop there. The difference is it's just really hard. You know, it's really difficult. It takes a long time. And there's a lot, you know, you sit with a nice spreadsheet and you kind of say, okay, if I have this many writers creating this much content, I'll need this many editors. The content will just neatly flow through all of those people and it'll be fine. And actually what happens is, this client wants a different report update. This client kind of doesn't like your content process, wants to change it. This client wants to know if you can also write their social media posts. And you have to say no to a lot of that stuff because otherwise you end up like me, you know. You end up not sleeping, you end up aging very, very quickly. And it takes a little while to really get your arms around, okay, these are the things that we do. We can't do anything else. We do these and we do them extremely well and clients want it. But we have to say no to everything else so that we can continue to provide a great service and keep everyone healthy.
Learning to say no, such a great lesson here and also probably a good one in life, and stay focused on what actually matters and what in all regards. But now this has been such a fun episode, and I think an extremely helpful one too. If it's okay with you, I've just got four lightning round questions that I'd love to ask you in rapid fire succession. Does that sound good?
Sounds great. Let's do it.
All right. So I know you mentioned like you had previously started a niche site and you sold it. And so my question here is, would you start another one?
I did start another one. I currently have another one running right now. The previous one was in the no-code space. That's in the AI space. It's been painful with Google updates, but it's gone pretty well. And I think we'll probably do more.
Backlinks, more or less important than they were a year or two ago?
Probably more important. I think they continue to be the enduring sign of authority, and I just don't ever see them going away.
Writing tests, which we talked about earlier. What happens if you get back a piece of content and it's not very good and you're not going to hire that writer? Do you like throw that content away, or do you try to heavily edit it to make it usable?
We never really use, I think we did it once, but we never really use trial. Even if the piece is amazing, we don't use it. What we always try to do is give the writer a piece that we've already done but haven't published yet, and that way we compare it against what they've done versus our ready to publish but not yet live piece.
And my last question is on the annoying things that clients do. What is the most annoying thing that a client could do when working with you?
The thing I really struggle with is work that doesn't need to be done. Certain reports that really aren't useful to anyone, but we want them. Getting too involved. We always tell clients, like, hey, you think you care a lot about this content, but you really don't. As long as it doesn't embarrass you, like we're not saying something that disparages you, all you want is for it to rank. So you don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of, oh, you should change this, you should mention that. I think this would really enhance the article. Like, yeah, it would. But, we're writing two of these a day, and it's not going to help you with SEO. So there's a lot of 80-20 education that we need to do for our clients.
Well, now this has been such a great episode. And thank you for coming on the Optimize podcast. Is there anything else that you'd like to say to our listeners?
Yeah, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it. I think anyone who needs SEO help and wants to do it at scale, you can find us at masswithane.marketing. If anyone's interested in learning more about AI techniques, you can always find me. I'm on Twitter at Niall, or niall@mass-seo.com. Happy to help, happy to chat to anyone.
Yeah, and we will include a link back to your website and to your social handles in the show notes for all the listeners. So check that out. And Niall, thanks again for coming on the podcast. It was great chatting with you today.
Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of the Optimize podcast. This episode was brought to you by Positional. At Positional, we've got tools for content optimization, keyword research, internal linking, and so much more. We'd love for you to check Positional out at positional.com. And you can always reach out to me too if you have any questions at nate@positional.com.